Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and time.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and this is MJ Network, MJ in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, and this is going to be absolutely fantastic. We have Gabriel Vanjone here, and this is going to be a brand new series that he's writing, and let me give you a little hint about Shane Cleary. You want to read this because it's totally different and out there. He's a sharp character that breaks the rules and thinks out of the box, and just what happens at the final scene takes place lets you know that this author is going to write some more. The title of the book is Dirty Old Town. The character is Shane Cleary, and the author is Gabriel Vanjone. Welcome, and hi. Welcome back to MJ Network.
Oh, good morning, friend. Thank you for having me. It's nice to be back.
I'm glad you are. And the sun is shining, so it's going to be a beautiful day. So how did you create Shane, and why this time period?
Well, I was interested, as you may know, I live in Boston, and there's been a lot of crime fiction written in Boston. Dennis Lehane, Robert Parker, and George Higgins. And the thing I wanted to do that was different than them was I focused on the South End, which is where I live. Now, the South End today is quite gentrified, but back in the 1970s, it was a real, real hotbed for clubs, drugs. It was a multi-ethnic neighborhood, and I thought that would be a lot of fun to write about. It'd also be very different from, you know, my predecessors who wrote about Boston. And I chose the 70s because, well, I was a child during that time period, although I didn't grow up in Boston. A lot of the stuff, you know, I do remember from the 70s, and I also thought it would be fun because it's kind of revisiting my childhood. And I also like the fact that the 70s, well, wasn't exactly a politically correct time period, so that gave me a lot of fun.
That is really interesting. Did you model him after any real person or any real television character, or did you just invent this guy?
With Shane, I just pretty much, you know, created him, you know, inside my own head. I think I probably was very influenced by some of the TV shows during the 70s when you think about all the detectives. But I tried, you know, to really stay, you know, with my own creation, because when you do detectives, there's a lot of cliches and tropes that you see in TV shows and in books. So I wanted to do something different in that sense. So he's a completely fabricated person.
That's pretty good. You created him as if he's real, seriously. I mean, that's so scary. Oh, everybody, if you're listening, I actually got the review on Facebook. I tricked my computer, tricked my phone. It's there so that you can read it. And if you want to ask any questions, people, it's there. See, I knew I'd get around it somehow. So tell us about his past and why he's no longer with the Boston Police. Because in order to create this kind of character, you had to come up with his own past.
Right. And I don't spend too much time in backstory. You know, the book opens up with him sleeping in his office because he can't pay the rent. So he's hiding from his landlord. So he's in his office, which is actually based on a real building here in Boston on Washington Street. Mm. So he's holed up in the apartment, and he's got his cat with him, Delilah. And, he's hard up on money. You know, he needs to pay the rent, and he gets a phone call. And he ends up taking the case because he's desperate. Now, you asked about the Boston Police Department. So here's an individual who does have investigative skills. He left the police department pretty much drummed out because he had witnessed a I would guess what you would call a non-justified shooting. He saw somebody in the police department shoot a young African-American kid, and Shane had to testify against him, which pretty much, you know, exiles him from the police force. So one of the ongoing tensions in the first book is he has police officers that would like to do him in because they feel he betrayed them. Mm. As for the case he takes on, you know, as I said, he's desperate, so he actually takes on a blackmail case. The rub here is that he doesn't like the man who hires him, and the man who hires mm-hmm. him married his high school girlfriend. So he's, you know, he's kind of carrying a torch for her, but, you know, hey, he's got to pay the rent, so he takes the case.
Yeah, he's pretty scary. That's Braddock. So tell us about Kat. She's an interesting character. And what was there really? Well, it was his girlfriend, but how does he feel seeing her with someone else? Not good.
Well, Kat is somebody he met when, as I said, you know, in his teen years. Now, her particular situation is she comes from money, and she married somebody who had more money. The problem was is that Kat's parents and her family ran out of money. So they have a lot of social prestige, but they didn't actually have money. And you can say she got accustomed to a certain lifestyle. So she married up and left Shane behind. Now, Shane, in his teen years, fell hard for her. It was his first love. He also is attending a school that, you know, his parents paid for, that was basically a private school, but he stays on a scholarship, you know, after there's a devastating loss in his family. Mm-hmm. And because of that loss, he has to go figure out what to do with his life. And then he sees her leave and marry this guy who he thinks is a creep.
I know, prejudgment. Well, he probably is. So, who is Jimmy, and who asked him to find the missing man named Roger? That was his friend, too.
Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, one of the things I loved mm-hmm. about this time period is that it wasn't politically correct, and mm-hmm. also you have a lot of things going on in the 70s, feminism, the gay movement. Jimmy is gay. He's also an arsonist. Mm-hmm. Shane's friend, mm-hmm. Bill, who is gay, in the
yeah.
closet, on the police force, asks Shane. Now, mind you, Shane's already got a case going for him. He's got the blackmail case that he's been hired to do. While, you know, walking, Bill approaches him. You know, he's in uniform, comes to him and says, hey, I want you to look into, you know, this missing person. And it's, you know, completely off the books because the guy he's looking for is not officially missing yet. But, you know, Shane does it because Bill is his friend and an ally. He goes looking for this person. When he starts investigating, he gets a lead to go talk to Jimmy. And Jimmy does not know Shane at this point. This is the first time they ever meet. But Jimmy knows of this missing person, so Shane's trying to work that angle. And Jimmy's an interesting character.
Yeah, he is.
You know, as I said, he's an arsonist, so he's also very guarded and kind of shady in many ways. He's known for carrying a meat cleaver.
That is scary. A lot of the characters were scary in this book, too. And
well, Jimmy,
I just sat down.
Jimmy's actually based on somebody I know. Who did?
Oh, good. That's nice.
And he did. He was not an arsonist. He was an exotic dancer in the 70s, and he did carry a cleaver inside his jacket. So that came from real life there.
That is cool. So, you know, when you listen to the police department and you listen to some of the ridiculousness on the news. And what would happen if it came out that he was gay in the police department, even today? How would they react to it? I mean, what difference does it make? So what?
I think today we have more enlightened attitudes, although I think there is still discrimination and homophobia in law enforcement. I would like to think that it's not as bad today as it was back then. Back then, if you got outed, it was a real problem because, you know, as law enforcement officers will tell you, you know, you depend on your brothers and sisters so that, you know, mm-hmm. if you're out there and something happens, you know, you're going to get a backup. You know, if you're gay or in this case, Shane, who testified against another cop, if he had stayed on the mm-hmm. on the force, there's a good chance nobody would come and back him up. Bill stays in the closet, and this story takes place in 1975. You know, this is mm-hmm. things that we know today, like gay pride marches. That wasn't so out in the open. I mean, there was a gay liberation movement, but it was not accepted overnight, just like what they then called women's lib was also not overtly accepted.
I'm just writing something. So, this time period, people did not understand about a gay policeman and whatever, but it was kind of hard, and Bill was able to sort of hide it. So tell us more about this police department. It was corrupt. We know that. Sports agents, even in case real-life real estate, it's different. It's not much different than today. I mean, just because it was 1975, I'm sure you did research, doesn't mean that we don't see this kind of thing today. We just don't hear about it, or maybe it's different. I mean, even there was something on the news a while ago, we won't say who said it, that they don't want gay people
right.
in the Army. That, what can I say?
Well, like I said,
I'm
not surprised it's still going on. I mean, I hope I'm not being naive saying it, but I hope that things mm-hmm. are better today than they were back then. Now, don't get me wrong. A lot of cities, Boston included, had a very active gay life. Mm-hmm. Lifestyle. They had their own scene. They had bar circuits, dance clubs. People knew where to go to meet, you know, their partner, mm-hmm. whether you were a lesbian or whether you were gay. So I mean, it wasn't, you know, completely under a rock, but you had to know where to look. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, it was tolerated only because there was a lot of corruption. You know, club owners paid mm-hmm. off people to make sure they didn't get raided. Sometimes mm-hmm. they paid or dropped a dime on a competitor and paid to get them raided so they can stay in business. I don't know if most listeners would know this, but, you know, the 70s also, mm-hmm. you know, there were a lot of movies about cops and corruption, mm-hmm. Things like Serpico. The Wambaugh novels all became, well, not all of them, but most of them became movies. Now, those cops in the Wambaugh series were pretty much in the 60s, but he did go into the 70s. And you see that there was corruption, cops looking the other way, maybe being flexible on letting somebody go. Conversely, you also have the opposite where, you know, there weren't as many rules and safety measures today protecting citizens. So cops got very hand happy with people. And, you know, mm-hmm. you hear things like, you know, guys resisting arrest and falling down a flight of steps while he still had the handcuffs on and all kinds of problems. So there was police brutality. And sometimes that was, you know, against minorities or against gay people. So that did happen. I mean, we still have elements of that today, unfortunately. But like I said, I hope that it's not as bad as it was back then. I mean, cops in the 70s and civic groups couldn't resort to a body cam to see what happened. It just happened, and you had to take, you know, somebody's word against each other.
It's sad because people are not open-minded. And then when you think about what's happening in the world now, you would think that people realize that it's about time that you gave all this a rest and we just started to work together as it doesn't matter what your beliefs are, you're just who you are. If you're a good person, so what?
Right.
You're gay, so what? But it's
right.
sad. And with this pandemic,
but I also
going to wise up.
You know, in this book too, I mean, I want readers to know, I mean, this isn't all dark. I mean, there are good people in this book. John mm-hmm. Shane becomes very good friends with John, who is a African-American bartender who actually emigrated north. He's originally from Mississippi. They went to Chicago, and he's married to a lovely woman named Sylvia who owns her own business. She owns a restaurant in Dorchester. She's a cook. She does soul food.
Mm-hmm.
John becomes an ally for Shane. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do was that if you are on the outs or on the fringe, you need allies. And sometimes they are people that you least expect. It could be an arsonist. It could be a guy who runs a bar. You know, John's bar is located in Central Square, which is, you know, one of the things I wanted to do in this series is show people different parts of Boston. Central Square was and had a lot of bars back then and a lot of drug activity, but also had a lot of community activism. It was really a hotbed where people went to hear alternative views. There was a lot of printing presses. There was a feminist annex there, and next door to it, they had a martial arts class. People were, you know, getting into self-protection and advocacy for other things like the environment. So there's still, hopefully, when you read this book, you'll see that there are positive light and, you know, good examples. It's not all bad people.
I know. This is interesting, though. I'm reading my review, which is absolutely, I think it's pretty good. Not bad.
Okay.
I don't know. I had, yesterday was like, I don't know what happened, and I got this thing from WordPress that 75 people read something I wrote, and then they're following me now, and I go like, how come? And that's nice.
Okay.
It's like, oh my God, 75 people in one day read something I wrote. I don't. So what happened? Tell us about the death of an auditor named Dunbar. And
I'm sorry.
Said the death. Tell us about the death of the auditor named Dunbar and the death of the missing man named Roger. What did you include the death of Dunbar? What is the significance of his death in particular in this particular novel?
Well, Dunbar comes in as a lead to Shane because, as I said earlier, Shane was initially hired to investigate blackmail. The man who hires him believes he's being blackmailed. And what had happened was he was receiving Xerox copies. And the blackmailer was basically letting him know that he had access. He somehow found the ledgers and has a full view of everybody who's involved. And the interesting thing here is that the man who hired him is what he's doing is actually legal. But because there was such a public outcry against urban renewal in Boston because it would destroy a lot of neighborhoods, he was threatening to expose the real estate dealings, which obviously involved many, many wealthy people. The man who hires him, Brayton, believes that he knows who's blackmailing him, but he can't prove it. So that's where Dunbar comes in. And Shane, you know, basically is hunting him down to try to find him. And, you know, we'll confront him. But I don't want to give anything away because not everything is
what
it
seems. No,
we can't
tell. Okay, this part I really was interested in. Because lately I've been reading an awful lot of books with animals. I just finished one by Margaret Handler called The Winter of the Wolf. And it's about the Inuits and this boy that kills himself. Well, not really. It's a different kind of death. And how the wolf seems to take the place of a human and how different animals. So tell us about the cat and how you created this cat to have human emotions. Because a lot of people are doing that. And I'm finding that I like the animals sometimes better than the people. That's interesting.
Well, the cat, the name of the cat is Delilah. And yeah. I created it, you know, one, because I have a cat. At the time I wrote this, I had two, but they had since passed. But I incorporated their personalities in the cat. And the cat is, in many ways, the voice of conscience for Shane. And, you know, they know each other well, and she can read his emotions, and she could also call him on something, and he knows it. But, you know, I think, you know, when you're reading something that is very vivid, real, sometimes dark, I think you need a little bit of a light comic element so that, you know, you can enjoy a laugh. And Delilah does that sometimes. You know, I'd like to think she offers a little bit of a comedic element to the story when it starts getting dark. But she's going to be a recurring character. Delilah doesn't go away.
Well, I wonder what happened if she could really talk, seriously. She'd probably have an awful lot to say about him.
Well, she uses her claws when she wants to talk.
Yeah, well, she probably would have a lot to say and probably put him in his place because she's a smart cat. So who is Elizabeth, and why does she decide to take care of Delilah?
Well, part of the, you know, there's times when Shane is out, and as I mentioned in the beginning, he's living out of his office. So until he can get his rent situation squared away, he's got the cat staying in the office. And he, when he's out working, you know, he wants somebody to look in on the cat and take care of her, feed her, that kind of thing. So it's just a little bit more of a, I guess, common sense type of thing. You don't want to leave your cat totally abandoned. So
well, we have, my next door neighbor had two cats, and my Albie, when he passed away, was so sad because he was my pal. He used to like to come sit on my foot and have a word with me and talk. He actually communicated,
yes.
I decided. And we opened the door. We could never find him because he was hiding here somewhere. So now she has only one cat, and this cat stays inside. They're house cats. So they're
right,
okay.
Right.
And Pierce,
yeah, Delilah's the same way in the sense that she's a house cat, but she doesn't hide. You know, in fact, she actually confronts Shane on one or two occasions when she's not exactly happy with him.
You see, that's it. I told you she's a smart cat. So he had to leave his home and his office. How does he manage to elude the police? But they get him after a while. I mean, I felt like I wanted to smack the police officers. He's just trying to do something. And no matter what he does, he seems to be labeled as, we're going to get you for whatever you did in the past. So how does he deal with
well,
that? He's never safe in one place.
He moves around a lot, but the thing is here, I mean, in Dirty Old Town, he actually has confrontations with the police. Now, you got to remember, Bill is his friend. So Bill also buys time for him. How he manages to stay alive gets, the answer comes in book two.
Because
he finds out
fair.
Something.
I knew
so
there
you'll,
was
you'll
gonna
have
be
to,
another one. And I take it I'm going to get it before
one.
Everybody else.
Yes, you will. If all goes well, the second book, which is called Symphony Road, will hopefully come out in January.
Well, I just got an email from Cheryl, who's on the line. Hi, Cheryl, who said that she wants it too because she's going to read all of your books because this is the first one she's read and she really loved it. So
okay.
That's a good thing. That is a good thing, yeah. Seriously, you know, but with what's going on with publishing and stuff like that, and people, I don't write bad reviews ever. If I don't think a book is like 4.5 stars, at least I won't four and a half stars. I won't review it. I'll just write a summary.
Right.
Because it's not my job to tell somebody that your book is horrible, or that I hate it, or something like that. The only time I ever did that is when somebody had 750 typos, and then I explained to the person, you need to get this redone because I'm not reading it. So, tell us about the barbarian. He's scary. What does he learn that sends him on the trail to find him?
Well, the barbarian introduces the element of organized crime in this story.
Yeah, cool.
He actually is based on a real person.
Oh, good.
And he was called the barbarian. So when you think about Boston in the 70s, a lot of organized crime, you know, the Sicilian Mafia, they were in New England, but they moved primarily down to Rhode Island. Now, you'll see this in Dennis Lehane's books, where he talks about South Boston, which is where a lot of criminal elements were, but they were mostly Irish. There was a big war in organized crime in throughout the 60s in Boston. And the way I understand it was there was some kind of agreement was reached where organized crime would have one particular person representative of, you know, the mafia, basically. That person would be in the North End, and the organized crime moved down to Rhode Island for the most part and interacted with New York and, you know, Philadelphia and other major hubs for activity. The Barbarian was essentially a hitman and a total sociopath. As I said, he was based on a real person. He is deceased. To give you an example of how out of control he was, when he got a contract, usually, you know, you go and, you know, you get that person, that target, you kill them. In a real event, what had happened when he was given a contract for somebody, he staked out where the person lived. And it was one of these apartment buildings where the man lived, the target lived with his family. And it was a multi-generational family. He had his grandmother, aunts, and all that stuff living in the building. So he staked him out, figured out his routine. You know, the man would come down at X time, you know, to get his newspaper, whatever. What he did was he set fire to the building so that people would come rushing out. And he basically shot everybody that came out of the building. So he went deliberately to kill this man, but ended up killing other elements of his family. And that's not something you do. I mean, you go, and when you have a contract, you take care of that person. You don't do above and beyond that. You know, you don't deliberately try to have collateral damage. So he was a very, very larger than life individual, much feared, so bad that actually lawyers didn't want him as a client. He was known for attacking people in court, and I think ultimately he was taken care of because he disappeared in 1976. But he was a real person.
So what would happen in real life or in retrospect for this barbarian if people paid him money, we know that, and if a lawyer or somebody turned him down, would he kill him? I mean, was there such a thing as you don't turn me down or you're going to be dead, like in a mafia kind of thing or worse?
Well, the problem with him was that even within organized crime, nobody can control him. You know, he eventually became a mercenary. He didn't belong to, you know, one family, if you were to think of it as loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
So he became a gun for hire. And the problem was is just that he enjoyed what he did, and he went above and beyond in all the worst ways possible. So a lot of people started going the way, you know, from what I read in my research, a lot of people were trying to figure out a way to get rid of him. They couldn't get the charges to stick against him. And they went to, you know, figures in organized crime and said, you know, you gotta keep a lid on this guy or get rid of him. He's making everything bad for business. But he managed to be very elusive. And he was somebody who would kill you on a whim just because, you know, he wanted to. So Shane eventually comes up against him.
That is really scary.
Yes.
I mean, he took his life in his hands at a time just to do what he wanted to do to protect other people and to get this case solved. So
Yeah.
How would you describe his personality if somebody did a profile on him? And I know that he was once for the murders of Roger Sherman and Dunbar. I mean, if there was a crime to be committed, even if he didn't commit it, they wanted to get him because the police were just out for him, poor Shane.
You have to think about it. You have to think about it in the sense that nobody would testify against him. So you had witness intimidation. He definitely had cops on the take. He was paying off people. He was killing informants. And, you know, I'm not, you know, qualified to do a profile, but I would definitely say he was a sociopath. He had no moral compass. You know, he either did things for pleasure or he did it for money. And the fact that he had no moral compass is what made him, you know, unstable and very dangerous to everybody around him. You know, you have to think that, you know, people who are doing illegal activities don't want to have attention drawn to themselves. And then you have this, you know, cowboy show up and, you know, if you're in a situation where you have no choice but to deal with him, then you have a liability on your hands. Profile, I would say, you know, psychopath or a sociopath, but probably more towards sociopath. He really did not care.
Yeah, I know he didn't. He seemed very cavalier at times. And at times he just sort of like, I'm going to do this. But does he think out before he does it, or he just does it because he thinks it's the right thing to do?
The Barbarian or Shane?
Shane, both of them. Well, the Barbarian doesn't care. He's going to kill people no matter what.
Shane tries to think through things that, you know, when he goes to do it, you know, because he has to think all the angles because he knows that things could blow up on him because he's got the cops after him. You know, the cops are looking to pin anything on him. He doesn't have that many friends, so the friends that he have are allies that are themselves on the fringe. So he's very calculated. The Barbarian's not. He's very much, you know, doing things, making it up as he goes along because he just is a kind of, you know, an extremely impulsive person. One of the things I found out in the research on the real Barbarian was that he used to like biting people. You know, he would get close to people and then actually bite them, which always made me wonder, you know, what dental forensics were back then in the 70s, because he bit several people.
Would you say he's like the Charles Bronson character?
I'm sorry, what?
Would you say he's like the Charles Bronson character?
No, I the Barbarian, I would say, is deadly. Shane is I wouldn't say Shane is a vigilante. I think he is, you know, the opposite. He has certain principles, moral principles, although sometimes they slide a little. you know, it's I don't want to give that away, but I think Shane is a good person, and I think one of the things that was fun in writing the book was how Shane, in many ways, is naive and idealistic. You know, he's a big fan of Marlowe. You know, it was something he saw. It was the films he saw growing up. He admired, you know, the principles of the detectives and how they often did things to solve the case but still try to hold to some kind of code. He tries to do that, and I think, or I hope, readers will see, you know, as Shane progresses through his investigations, he's realizing that the real world is a lot more complicated and a lot more grayer, because that's reality.
But I don't think he's ever going to make friends with the police department. I think he's always going to come up against them no matter what. I don't think they're going
right.
to leave him alone. See, I got that. See, not bad for the person at the beginning here. So before I ask any more questions, What other characters came to play in this particular novel? I didn't include all of them in my review because I don't want to give everything away. But who else would you say that was on his side, if anybody else, besides this one?
Well, I would say, you know, I mentioned Bill, who's his friend, who's a cop, closeted. You know, you have Jimmy, who becomes an ally.
Mm-hmm.
He's an arsonist and gay. I briefly mentioned John and Sylvia, the black couple who become friends and help them out. The one person I haven't mentioned is
mm-hmm.
Delano, who is,
mm-hmm.
Shane calls him the professor. He's a teacher, an old teacher, a friend
mm-hmm.
of Shane's. And he, I guess you could say Delano is kind of like a father figure to
mm-hmm.
Shane. So the backstory with him is that he became Shane's teacher during the high school years, teaching literature, teaching Latin. He had lost his job as a professor, and I'll let readers figure out what happened there, but he always took care of Shane. You know, he gave him money, you know, he would put money inside the books, send them books to read. But Delano now is older, so he's dealing with discrimination, being older, trying to find a job. But he's also a sounding board for Shane. You know, he can go to him for advice. And sometimes it's, you know, a little bit funny. Sometimes it's serious. And he's also going to be a recurring character.
Oh, good.
Yes.
That was one of my questions. So who, before I ask a whole bunch more, who
yes.
are you bringing back? Who are you going to bring back in the next one?
Delilah, definitely.
Oh,
she's
good.
Not
well,
going anywhere.
Oh, good.
You will see Bill again.
Oh, good.
He's in the second one. Not as much, but he's there. Jimmy will be there. So let's see. I'm trying to think of who else I haven't. You will be meeting a bunch of new characters in the second book. You will also have a recurring villain who is in the first
oh,
one but
good.
Doesn't have a name. So he'll be showing up in the second one. So I that's about three or four. John and Sylvia will be there too. So I tried to, you know, through each book, have his allies somehow help him with the case, sometimes a little bit more than others from book to book. But you do have this core of friends that Shane has that will be going through, you know, each book and each particular mystery or investigation.
Well, that means you can't kill them off. Sorry. But you know about it, kill
yes.
them off. Well, you know, it's funny that you should say villain, recurring. On May 28th, I'm going to do a panel show with four brave people.
Okay.
Charles Salzberg, Bruce Kloffman, R.G. Belsky, and Tom Walsh. I spelled the name wrong on my phone here, which is not a good thing. And we're going to talk about how do you choose your killer and how do you choose how he commits the murder. And I thought that was different. Creating the right killer in a novel requires many difficult choices. So is the killer someone that the main character knows, or is it someone that just happens to be there? So when you choose your killer in this particular book, how do you choose who it is? And how do you choose the way the person commits the murder, which is what the panel
well,
is going to be about? It's interesting.
I try not, you know, with anything I've written, I try not to be too graphic. You know,
mm-hmm.
when it comes to murders, I don't think I do anything ingenious. I mean, if the person, you know, dies, it's usually, you know, through some fairly simple way of either being shot or stabbed. But, talking about villains, so as I mentioned, you know, you have one, in this book that will be in the second one, who is not named. He's only known by a physical feature that he has. I do,
mm-hmm.
however, have a character in the first book that will recur in the second one that is a killer. but he's also Shane's friend, and that's Tony Two Times. He's basically a mobster's right hand, and it's very, very clear that he's a very dangerous individual. But he also respects Shane, and Shane, you know, makes it a point to stay on his good side because Shane ultimately meets the remaining mafia don in Boston, and they have an interesting relationship because he turns out to be an ally, but you know, he obviously has an agenda, and he, you know, has his own stakes to protect. So, you know, Shane's trying to make sure that he stays on the right side of the line when he deals with this guy. But Tony Two Times is often the messenger. He shows up with a message, and he's not exactly somebody you can turn away.
That's scary. So how do you take, I mean, a killer that's bad as your best friend, and you know he's a killer, and yet Shane's not going to turn him in, is he? He's just going to do whatever he says because it's his friend. He's not going to turn him in.
No, he's not going to turn him in. But the difference between Tony Two Times and somebody like the Barbarian Tony Two Times is somebody who functions by a set of rules. You know, he's not going to go after innocent people. You know, he's not going to hurt somebody just for the sake of hurting him. You know, if he's doing something, it's because he's got orders and there's a rationale behind that, even if he might not understand it because he's loyal to his boss. And Shane has no reason to have an argument with him because they kind of see eye to eye. You know, you can kind of say the rules are unspoken, but they exist between the two of them. So they kind of, you know, have this very tense respect for each other.
He's sort of like somebody you want for a friend. Both of them. Seriously.
Yeah.
You seriously want somebody on your side like that when things get tough. Seriously. But I think I would take Shane rather than the criminal. No, really.
Yes.
In the end, Shane learned some hard lessons about himself regarding trust and love. You can't trust anybody anymore in these books. What would he say he learned about himself, and what would he change about himself if he could? But I think he likes himself the way he is.
Well, I think Shane likes himself, but I also think he realizes that, you know, he is naive. You know, a lot of that, I think, comes through, you know, when you read the story and you see how he is with Kat, his former flame. He's also trying to come to terms with what he's done in life. I mean, you know, he held to the code of being honest and he testified against a cop. You know, so the issue of loyalty gets questioned, but he also the issue of morality. And this is not so pronounced in the first book, but it will become a recurring theme, is that Shane's a Vietnam vet. And his experiences in war will become will come to the forefront in later books. And I'm trying to be very respectful of that in the sense that I do not want to do things that are cliched about PTSD or anything like that. Shane does have the capacity to be violent.
Yeah, I know.
And that's also something he tries to keep in check because, you know, he if he's going to be violent, he wants it to be on justifiable terms, not just to be, you know, a rage machine. So I think, you know, by the end of the book, he starts realizing that, you know, one, he can do this whole thing, you know, being a PI. He wasn't exactly, I think, 100% confident in the beginning, but I think he feels more confident about his abilities. But I also think he realizes that, you know, he's been kind of looking through the world through rose-colored glasses. And I think he is, in some ways, pleasantly surprised that the people who he thought wouldn't help him do help him. So I think, you know, he's sort of mistrustful, but yet at the same time, he's not completely distrustful. You know, people like Jimmy help him, John and Sylvia help him. So there's emotional growth.
So if you write about PTSD, because everybody writes about that, are you going to write it
right.
as flashbacks that things happened to him and what they happened? I'm so used to people writing about the war. Sometimes it's clear and sometimes it's unclear. Sometimes they write it in the middle of the chapter, this paragraph, they go, what? And they go like, wait a minute, where did that come from? So are you going to do that like in italics or something?
No, I like I said, I've been trying to think about ways where I want to be respectful, but at the same time, I do not want to do what everybody else has been doing.
Yeah.
You mentioned a lot of times people do flashbacks. Those are hard to do when you write because they can take a reader out of the story because, you know, you're thinking, okay, this is happening in present time. And, you know, italics is one way that people, one way that writers signal there's a shift or a change. Another way that they might do that is a section break or like a scene break to let people know that, oh, you know, later that day, later that morning, that kind of thing. I think with PTSD, which is still a problem with former military, and you also have to be careful too that with writing something historical, like something in the 70s, you use the right terminology because the whole growth of psychology has changed since the 70s. The names for PTSD have been different almost every decade, and then it now is officially recognized, and it's in the diagnostic manual for doctors and for mental health professionals. I think one of the things that might be an effective technique for Shane is to have him do something, but then maybe realize one of the things I found fascinating about PTSD is the suppressed memories. Something will happen, and the individual realizes that they completely forgot that experience. And I thought that might be an interesting technique because there you can get very evocative. It doesn't necessarily have to be something violent. It could be a scent. It could be an image that will trigger the flashback. But I'm not interested in the flashback per se. I'm interested in why he suppressed it or why he thinks, hold on a second, this happened. Why don't I remember that? And I think one of the psychological theories behind that is when some memories become so distasteful and so unpleasant, you tamp it down, you forget it. It's almost like amnesia is a protective mechanism.
I get what you're saying.
So I think that would be for PTSD. You know, I don't want to write a battle scene. I don't want to write something that happened in Vietnam. I want to show how somebody, you know, is trying to function today, you know, in relative terms and in the present moment, realizing that they have a whole chunk of their history that they subconsciously forgot. And I think it's true that, you know, from what I've read and from veterans I've known, you know, particularly World War II or Korea, you know, these men came home. They did not talk about it. They just literally, you know, they put their stuff in a box, put it in the basement, and just never talked about it. It was not considered manly to talk about your feelings. You know, I've known individuals that found out, like, their father was in a horrific battle, and they didn't know about it until they found the paperwork. Sadly, sometimes after his death. And they're like, oh, my God, you know, he was in Guadalcanal. He never talked about it. Or, you know, he got this, you know, citation. He never displayed it, never talked about it. You know, that's sad.
Yeah, I know. It's sad. My uncle was in World War II. He was there when they put the flag down. So, and they never talked about it. They wouldn't say anything about it. And I wanted to know a lot. about it. No one would talk about that. My other uncle wouldn't talk about that either. It was sort of like,
right.
This is what happened, and I went to war. And my father was in the Merchant Marines. He was a 4F, and he went
right.
anyway. He decided to go.
Right.
My nephew is in South Korea, everybody. My nephew, Robbie, he just became a staff sergeant, first class,
right.
and
right.
he's in his fourth tour in South Korea. And I pray each day that
yes.
he doesn't get the coronavirus or that he's okay,
which is
amazing. But
right.
so before we end, tell everybody
yes.
about your other series, so that this is a time when publishing companies are having problems. As a reviewer, to be very honest, I'm not getting everything that people are sending me. There's about 30 people
okay.
that asked me for book reviews in the last 2 weeks, and the books are not coming. So tell everybody about your other series and where we can learn more about you and your work, because you want to read the other series too, people. Trust me.
Okay. So I have a total of 3 series. I have 2 of them with another publisher, Winter Goose Publishing. One
mm-hmm.
series is set, it's contemporary. I would say kind of a contemporary mystery thriller, and it's set in and out of Italy. Sometimes the stories are in the U.S., mostly Boston, but most of the times they're in Italy. So you get introduced to Italian culture, and that's the Roma series. With Winter Goose, I also have the Company Files. I should mention that with the Roma series, I have 5 books. With the Company Files, this is with Winter Goose, and it's historical. It starts in the late 40s. The first book is in Vienna right after the war. The second book, which I was nominated for an Agatha Award, is
nice.
Set in 1951 in Hollywood, and that deals with the Blacklist, screenwriters, and the early rivalry between the CIA and the FBI. So there's 2 books there. I'm editing the third one, which is called Diminished Fifth, and that will be dealing with off-Broadway and organized crime and the CIA.
Nice.
Now, Level Best Books is the publisher for the Shane series. The first one, you know, we talked about today, Dirty Old Town. I'm editing the second one, which is Symphony Road. That, again, is Boston. We're in 1976. It involves a string of arson fires. And this time, one of the arson fires has a dead body. And my character, Jimmy, gets accused of it. And he insists
oh,
that
nice.
He did not do it. And he asks Shane for help. I have 5 books planned in the Shane Cleary series, so hopefully each January you'll see one. Now, back to the point about publishers having a hard time. Unfortunately, with Corona, things are very much
yeah.
disrupted. I do have to say, however, that many independent bookstores are shipping books.
Yeah, they are. You're right.
You know, they take orders over the phone or through the web, and they ship things out. You know, for people who prefer, you know, paper copy, digital is there. You can get that from pretty much all the major stores. You know, like Barnes and Noble and Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of independent bookstores also show. You know, they also can give you digital copies through their website. Another place that's doing things for writers is libraries are doing
mm-hmm.
electronic loans with books, movies, TV, you name it. I do think, you know, the thing that hurts most right now for publishers and writers is that a lot of events have been canceled.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Malice has been canceled.
Bourgeois, yeah. The only thing
yeah.
that's really hard is also is the fact that new releases are in digital and I can't read them. So I've been waiting
okay.
for print copies of the new releases to come out because those are not on Amazon. You can pre-order. And what happened was
you can pre-order,
Kate White's
okay.
publicist approached me like last month, and she said, "Did you get the book? We had a pre-release copy." I felt so bad that they sent me two copies and they never got here. I did something that I never do. I went and bought the. I'm going to get the book tomorrow. I ordered it because I figured if they really want me to review it that badly, and they keep finding out if I get it, got it. So before we end, Cheryl has a question.
The other thing I wanted to mention.
Go on.
No, the one thing I do want to mention is if you look on Facebook or you Google your favorite author, particularly if it's a series you follow, you'll find that sometimes a lot of these authors are doing readings online with other authors, they either through Zoom or through the other one, Crowdcast. For example, tomorrow night I'm doing a virtual reading, a noir at the Bar of Boston. So you can see my Twitter feed. You have the details there for a link to Crowdcast. I'll be with Edwin Hill, Daniel Ford. I'm blanking on the list, but you'll see on my Twitter feed there's about like five writers, and it's kind of a virtual happy hour. Each one of us gets to talk about our book and maybe read, for about 5 minutes. This is a way, I think, for readers to get to know writers. For me as a writer, it's nice knowing that, I can contact people and see people, especially since we're doing quarantine. I would suggest people look online. These events are free. You just kind of have to register, and then when you register, you'll get like an email like an hour before the event to remind you. And once you click on the link, because you're already registered, you go right in. All these events usually have like a little chat stream on the right side where you can ask questions to the author, to the host. So it's very interactive, and like I said, it's a resourceful way of dealing with isolation. And
thank you so much, because time is running.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you so very much. This has been fun, really. I can't wait to get the next one now that I'm getting to know Shane a whole lot better than I did before. And it's beautiful outside. It's a gorgeous day. For those of you, go on Amazon, go on Goodreads. Strand Books has been selling books, have been digital stuff also. For those people that don't know Strand, they're fantastic too. The library up here in Greenberg is doing that also. Lots of books online that you could read. So thank you so much. Everybody have a beautiful
day.
Gabriel, I hope. I may tag you for do you do panels?
I'm sorry?
You do panel shows on different topics?
I have not done panel shows yet. The Noir at the Bar is going to be my first virtual reading ever, but I have not done panels. I do panels at conferences, but not virtually.
No, I do them on my radio show. I do. I just ask people if they want to do this, and it's a lot of fun. But thank you so much. Everybody have a great day.
Thank you.
And bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.